Hi, this is Cale Clark. Welcome to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio mobile app. I'm so glad that you're with me today for this journey of exploring, understanding, explaining, and defending our Catholic faith. I've got a question from Carlos in Chicago who asks, "Hi, Cale. Thank you so much for your program. Why are there so many differences in the Gospels? For example, with the Christmas stories." Okay, that's a really good question, Carlos. I want to get into that. And thank you for listening. That was Carlos in Chicago writing in. You can write in with your question, too. The email address is faith@relevantradio.com. You can also send a message to me on Twitter. You can tweet at me at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. Or at our show accounts, at Faith Explained for this program, at Cale Clark Show for my live program, which will be on the air later today, 5 p.m. Central. And yeah, this is a question that kind of relates to something that we were talking about yesterday on the program. Another question that we had about the Gospels and history. And in this recent debate, which I had mentioned, that took place between the skeptical scholar Bart D. Ehrman from the University of North Carolina and the Catholic apologist James Aiken, Jimmy Aiken, as he's more commonly known by, Bart made a big deal about this. And Bart would consider himself, by the way, at this point, an agnostic atheist. He's an atheist when it comes to the Christian God. He does not believe in the God of Christianity at this point, although he used to. But he considers himself an agnostic in general. But in his debate with Jimmy Aiken about the historicity of the Gospels, one of the things that Bart kept bringing up again was the Christmas narratives and why they're different. And you could almost see people who were watching the debate sort of saying, oh, maybe he's right, because they just haven't been schooled about this. They haven't thought about this. Why are there differences in the Gospels in general? And one of the big things that Bart said was that, you know, how can we believe in this when the Christmas stories seem to conflict, and two of the four Gospels don't even have a Christmas narrative about the birth of Christ? How can we believe in a moving star, for example, that the Magi follow to get to Jesus? That sort of thing. And so it's really important that we know the answers to these questions, because a lot of us don't learn this stuff growing up in Sunday school or even in the home, or if we've gone to a parochial school, a Catholic school, not in the parish either. But as we get closer and closer in time to Christmas or to Easter, what we often find are documentaries that appear on television. We find articles on the internet where people question these things. And oftentimes, believers don't know what to say in response. So the first thing I would say about this in terms of why the difference is we have to understand the genre of what we're reading. And we touched on this a little bit yesterday. I'm going to talk about it a little bit more later. What kind of literature are the Gospels? Are they a police report? Are they poetry? No, they're Greco-Roman biographies. Okay, they're historical biographies that conform to the standards of the time when they came out in the first century. And that's true of any book in the Bible. We've got to understand what kind of literature we're reading to get the gist of it, to get the meaning of it. The Psalms, you know, the worship songs of Israel. We have books of prophecy. We have books of poetry. We also have historical books in the Bible, and the Gospels fit into that mold, Greco-Roman first century biographies. So now with respect to what Bart Ehrman says about a moving star, that sort of thing, well, he's kind of playing on something that he's not being really explicit about there. When you're talking about history, the historian can't say what is or isn't possible in the supernatural realm. Okay, so there's no historian. A historian should never tell you that miracles aren't possible, for example, or you have to rule out everything in an account that seems supernatural. Okay, so what people think about that betrays more about their own personal worldview. Okay, so if you rule out miracles a priori, like, for example, the virginal conception of Jesus. I remember the talk show host Larry King from Larry King Live. You might remember him, of course. He was once asked, he was very famous for doing interviews. He was once asked, who would you interview if you could choose anyone in history? And he said, Jesus of Nazareth, for sure. I would like to ask him if he was indeed virgin-born, because the answer to that question would define history for me. That's a great point by Larry King. So if you rule out miracles a priori, out of hand, of course you will not give some of this stuff a second look. Of course you're not going to take it seriously in the first place. So it's important that we get that straight off the start. But let's take a look at the Christmas narrative situation. Is it a problem that Mark's gospel doesn't have an infancy narrative or a Christmas story? Is it a problem that John doesn't talk about it either? Although there are a couple things in John's gospel that kind of allude to the virginal conception of Jesus. So let's talk about that when we get there. But, all right, here are some of the problems that people will bring up when it comes to Christmas. And a friend of mine did a really good job of laying this out in his book, Greg Manette. And full disclosure, he is a friend of mine, but he wrote this incredible book called The Wrong Jesus. And if you want a sort of a starter package for reading about Jesus in history, this is a great one. And it's so good. The highest compliment I can pay this book is that I wish I wrote it myself. I wish I wrote it myself. It's so good. And he's not a Catholic. So there's some stuff in the book that I have quibbles with, but nonetheless, it's a really great layout of a lot of these questions. And he deals with this question in his book, talking about Christmas. And so, first of all, we all know that the date of Jesus' birth is a little bit off, because Jesus was actually born 5 years before Christ, if that makes any sense, 4 or 5 years B.C. Why do I say that? Jesus was born before Christ. Well, the calendar system that we have right now that we're using was actually created by a monk in the 6th century named Dionysius Exiguus. Now, he's not perfect in this regard. Now, he got his dates wrong by at least 4 years, maybe even 5 or 6, when he created our modern calendar. You got to think about this. Herod the Great persecuted Jesus as an infant, wanted to kill him. Now, Herod died in 4 BC, so Jesus had to have been alive at that time. Think about that. So things are off by a few years, but don't let that bother you too much, okay? So when it comes to this question of Christmas, the birth of Jesus, it is true that, you know, I talked in the last program about how our earliest sources about Jesus' life are actually not the Gospels, they're Paul's letters, because Paul wrote before the Gospels, okay? Paul's earliest letters are before the first Gospels that were written, in all likelihood. And even the first Gospel that was written, which is the Gospel of Mark, doesn't talk about the birth of Christ. It says very little about it. However, we do know that Jesus was born, okay? If someone tries to tell you that he didn't exist, and there are some people who claim this, they're considered crackpots, there is so much historical evidence for the existence of Jesus of Nazareth, even outside of the Bible, and I've talked about this in other episodes, that it's really not a tenable position to hold. So we do know that he was born, okay? Now, the question then becomes, what about the details that are brought up in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke about Christmas? Well, just really quickly, I do want to say that Mark and John, even though they don't have a Christmas narrative, they do mention some hints about the event. Now, for example, in John chapter 8, some of Jesus' opponents, some of the religious authorities of his day, one of the insults that they level at Jesus is they say, hey, we were not born of fornication. And that's in John 8:41. So they're implying that Jesus was born of fornication. And so they seem to know that there is something different about his birth, something out of the ordinary. And this rumor, which really is a great blasphemy to us as Catholics, began to be perpetuated. In fact, in later centuries, some Jewish writings talk about this terrible slander that a Roman soldier named Ben Panthera, the son of the panther, was actually the father of Jesus, had a relationship with Mary. And this is obviously blasphemous. It's not true. The virginal conception is the reality. Jesus doesn't have a human father. He does have a human mother. He does have his human nature from her. But the very fact that people said things like this seems to be sort of almost a very evil backhanded compliment to the virginal conception of Jesus. People knew something was different and they tried to explain it in different ways. And so we also see that some people try to claim in Mark chapter 6, verse 3, when people in Jesus' hometown of Nazareth, they don't believe in him necessarily. A lot of people say, well, this is the son of Mary. Some people see that as a slander. Oh, he's not really Joseph's son. We know that. There's something going on there. Now, it may be that Joseph has died by this point, and that's why he's called Mary's son. That's also quite plausible. But it could also be sort of a shot at the interesting situation around Jesus' birth from their perspective. At any rate, we do know a lot about the birth of Jesus through Matthew and Luke. Now, of course, you can look at Matthew chapter 1, chapter 2, and Luke chapter 1 and chapter 2. Now, they are different. They are different. And it seems like on the surface they're in conflict with one another, but it's actually not the case. And that's true of a lot of things in the Gospels. So I think the Christmas narratives are a good place to start. And it's good to bring that up because Bart Ehrman talks about this a lot in his debates with believers. It's good to see that these so-called conflicts actually aren't that big of a deal at all. In fact, there are 10 points of congruence between the two of them. As different as they may be, they both have 10 things in common, Matthew and Luke, when it comes to the birth of Christ. Number one, we know that Mary and Joseph, who of course are, Mary is Jesus' mother, Joseph the foster father, they are legally engaged or married. And in that time frame, in the first century Jewish world, if you're engaged, you're considered to be married legally. But we know that they have not lived together, okay? They haven't had any kind of relations. And we know that continued on, the virginal, the fact that Mary is ever virgin, it's not just the virginal conception of Jesus. Mary remained ever virgin throughout her life. It's one of the dogmas of the church. So that's mentioned in Matthew and Luke, Matthew 1:18 and Luke 1:27 and 1:34. The second thing, St. Joseph is from the lineage of King David. He's a descendant of King David. That's really important in Matthew's gospel. And that's mentioned in Matthew 1:16 and Matthew 1:20. It's also in Luke, though, too. Luke 1:27 and Luke 1:32 and also Luke 2, verse 4. The third thing that they have in common, both of the Gospels talk about the fact that angels announce that this child will be born. The fourth thing, Mary, of course, both Gospels note very well that Mary becomes pregnant while still a virgin. Number five, we know that the child is conceived by none other than the Holy Spirit. Matthew 1:18, Matthew 1:20, Luke 1:35. Both Gospels also tell us that an angel gives the child's name. The child's name will be called Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. And of course, the name Jesus is really Joshua in Hebrew. It means the same thing, God saves. So his name will be Jesus. That's in Matthew 1:21 and Luke 1:31. A seventh point of congruence. An angel also says Jesus is the Savior. Matthew 1:21, Luke 2:11. Another point, number eight, Jesus is born in Bethlehem. Both Gospels agree, despite their differences on some peripheral issues, Jesus is born in Bethlehem. Number nine, Herod the Great, we know this, I just talked about this a minute ago, he is in power during the time when Jesus is born. So he's still alive at this point. And then the tenth thing, Jesus becomes known as Jesus of Nazareth, even though he's born in Bethlehem. He's never called Jesus of Bethlehem because he grows up in the town of Nazareth. And that's mentioned in Matthew 2:23 and Luke 2:39 at the tail end of those Christmas narratives. So that's a lot of parallels, okay? Remember, Matthew and Luke, we talked about this last time, they're writing independently of one another. They don't have each other's gospel on their desk as they're composing. They're not calling each other or texting each other. Hey, what are you saying about this? So despite the fact that they're writing independently, there's a lot of points of agreement here, okay? So it's not nearly as bad as some people would have us believe. So even just looking at these 10 points that I just mentioned to you, we can reconstruct a pretty detailed sequence of events. I think this is really important for us to know. So yes, there are some alleged minor discrepancies in the birth accounts in Matthew and Luke, but this shouldn't trouble us at all. This shouldn't trouble us at all because they agree in all of the major points, all the most important things. Nazareth is the family home, okay? All kinds of stuff that I just mentioned. They go to Nazareth after the escape to Egypt in Matthew's gospel. There's all kinds of points of similarity. Luke says the family goes back to Nazareth after they go to Jerusalem, and this is where they see Simeon and Anna, all of that stuff. So, why the differences? Why the differences? And these are the things that people like Bart Ehrman get kind of hung up on, and they try to worry you about during debates. Well, it seems like a lot of people are again, unaware of the type of literature that the Gospels actually are, which is Greco-Roman biography. And here's something that biographers would do all the time. They would use something called compression. Now, what's compression? That's when you kind of shorten things up for the sake of brevity. You make a story shorter. And you kind of have to do that, right? Because Jesus spent somewhere between 30 and 33 years on planet Earth. You can't tell every single moment of his life, because if you did, it would take you 33 years to read the book. So obviously there's some compression going on, all right? And so a lot of accounts are kind of jammed together because of space reasons, okay, to be succinct. Here's another thing that ancient authors would do. It's called displacement. And that's when sometimes a writer will take things out of its original time context and put it somewhere else in the narrative. It doesn't mean it didn't happen. But here's a good example. This might be a good example of this. When you read John's gospel, Jesus cleanses the temple, quote unquote, his action in the temple precincts, where he overturns the tables of the money changers, makes a whip out of cords, and he's just so angry about a lot of different things. Now, that's at the beginning of his ministry in John's gospel, but in the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it happens right at the end. And in fact, this is one of the tipping points that the religious authorities say, this guy's gone too far, we need to take him out, he needs to be destroyed. So it happens around Passion Week. Now, it's possible that Jesus did it twice, and some have argued for that there were two cleansings of the temple, but I don't think that's what really happened. I think John is simply I think it happened around Passion Week, but John is rearranging the material. He's just moving that event to the beginning because he wants to make a theological point out of it. Okay, that Jesus is the new temple. All right, so it doesn't mean that didn't happen. And that was a perfectly legitimate way to do history in the first century. Maybe not today. Maybe if you're reading a biography of a modern figure, you're not expecting that at all, because that's not the way biographies are done. They're done chronologically, strictly, in today's day and age, but not the case in the first century, not the case in Greco-Roman biography. So that need not trouble you at all. So once you understand things like this, a lot of the alleged contradictions and problems kind of fall away. Now, one of the things that Jesus and his followers did all the time, this is how rabbis taught their students. They use something called the kreia. This is a teaching technique, kreia. It means a helpful story. And so in kreia, when Jesus was teaching his students, he expected them to remember the things that he taught them. He expected them to be able to explain it to other people. In fact, if they couldn't do that, they sort of failed the students. They'd be bad students or followers or disciples of their rabbi. But the one thing that you couldn't do was be like a parrot, you know, Polly want a cracker. You know, you could not simply memorize, although people in the ancient world had great memories, they can memorize huge blocks of material. By the way, that's really important for us to know too, that memories are really good. People did get the facts right. but you were not supposed to be a parrot in repeating your master's teaching back verbatim. In fact, if you did that, that would be considered, you failed the test. You've got to be able to contextualize it. You've got to be able to shrink it down sometimes. It's kind of like doing an elevator pitch. How do you explain the gospel to somebody in an elevator? You've got about 2 minutes. You have to shorten it up a little bit. If you have more time, if you're having a leisurely walk along the beach with somebody, you can explain the whole thing. But this is what you're expected to do, to be able to expand it, contract it as needed. But you weren't allowed to make it up. You weren't allowed to invent things out of whole cloth. That didn't happen. That was out of bounds. And so we see this happening as well with, for example, some of the speeches of Jesus in the gospel. If you look at Luke's gospel, Jesus talks about a lot of the same things he does in Matthew, but in a lot less words. And Luke is shortening the speeches for a reason, because Luke is a great historian. He knows Greco-Roman biography. He says Greek is excellent. He's well-read. He knows his stuff. And he's trying to make his gospel conform to the norms of Greco-Roman biography. That's why the speeches are shorter, very much like a lot of ancient books. Now, Matthew takes a little bit more time with certain things, like the Sermon on the Mount. It's pretty long. It's about 1,900 words. A lot longer than Luke's version, which is much, much shorter. But he still gets the gist of the teaching. So that might make you uncomfortable sitting here listening to this. Say, well, man, but trust me, ancient historians use this stuff all the time. So a lot of the alleged difficulties and contradictions kind of go away. And I don't think the way to go is to try to pretend that there aren't differences in the Gospels. There are. And I think if you try to look at it, there have been so many twisted and convoluted attempts to try to harmonize the Gospels, try to make everything fit together. That's not how they work. And I agree with Dr. Bart Ehrman that let Luke be Luke. Luke's Gospel is different than Matthew's. Let Luke be Luke. Let Mark be Mark. Let John be John. Let Matthew be Matthew. And that's fine. That's fine, because they do agree on the main contours, the main points about Jesus' birth, life, ministry, his teaching, his death, and the fact that he was resurrected. So on those points, they do agree. They do agree, although there are some of the details that one writer might emphasize more than another. So they're not bad historians. They're not being sloppy. Oh, man, I didn't check with Matthew on this. No, this was totally acceptable in the past. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. Okay, now in terms of history, though, I do want to clear up a couple questions that people have. And Bart Ehrman does bring up some of the stuff in his debates. There's some stuff in Matthew and Luke's Christmas narratives that are not mentioned by secular historians. For example, the fact that the Magi visited the baby Jesus. Herod the Great, when he slaughtered the innocents, when he ordered the death of every male child under 2 years of age in Bethlehem, both of those things, by the way, are mentioned in Matthew. And then in Luke's gospel, there's this reference to a census that was empire-wide, the entire Roman empire-wide, when a guy named Quirinius was governor of Syria. Now, some people say there's no record of this anywhere. So let's examine that just for a second. Okay, let's talk about the visit of the Magi. You should know that there are some ancient historians, and Greg Manette talks about this in his book, Dio Cassius, for example, Suetonius, another famous Roman historian. They wrote about wise men from the East, just like the Magi who visited Jesus. These wise men from the East read the stars, and they were motivated by this to go and pay homage to the Emperor Nero, the crazed emperor who burned down, in all likelihood, the city of Rome himself, and then blamed the fire on the Christians, unleashing this wicked persecution that led up to the deaths of Peter and Paul. So there is evidence in history for Magi doing this kind of thing. So it's not implausible that this would happen in the case of Jesus. So that it's not necessarily unhistorical or mythical at all. What about Herod killing all the children in Bethlehem? Again, this is something that Bart Ehrman makes a big deal about in his debates. There's no historian records this outside of the Bible, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. Herod did a lot of wicked and cruel things that weren't necessarily all written down. Herod had many of his own family members, including his wife and his three oldest sons, murdered during the final years of his reign when he just went insane. In fact, Emperor Augustus, he made a very famous joke. This is one of the famous jokes in all of history. He said, "I'd rather be Herod's pig than Herod's son." And the words for pig and son in Greek, they actually rhyme. So it's kind of a pun. Now, Herod fancied himself the king of the Jews. That's what he called him. That's why he was jealous of Jesus. Hey, well, hold on here. He's not the king of the Jews. I am. Augustus said, "I'd rather be Herod's pig than his son," because he's not going to kill his pig. Jews can't eat pork. So, but he will kill his sons. So, and that was his character. So this totally is in keeping with the way he was and how evil he was. And by the way, Bethlehem was pretty small during the birth of Christ. Less than 1,000 people lived there. So we're talking about maybe 20 kids who were 2 years of age and under, 20 male children who would have been killed. So it's kind of a blip on the radar screen. As horrific as this is, it's not something that historians of the ancient world necessarily would have taken notice of, but it's totally in keeping with Herod's character. All right, so we're kind of out of time right now, but if you have a question about the Catholic faith, I'll try to answer it on the air. You can send it to me via email. The address is faith@relevantradio.com, faith@relevantradio.com, or you can try to get your question to me on the X app. My handle is @CaleClark. I'll be with you later today at 5 p.m. Central for the Cale Clark Show live on Relevant Radio, and I'll see you in the next episode of The Faith Explained. God bless.